Hi, my name is John. I'm an alcoholic. I've been sober since May 16th, 2005. I have a sponsor, and I have a home group, which is the Midtown Group, and we meet on Sunday nights as well at 7:30 in Bethesda, Maryland. Actually, next week we're changing locations for a little while, for a couple of months, to Washington, D.C., just because the school that we meet at is under renovation. But normally we meet in Bethesda, Maryland. It's been my home group since I got sober in 2005. And if you're ever up in the area, we'd love to have you out. We got great coffee and cookies and a great greeting line with about 30 people. Your hand will get tired by the end of it. And it's a great place, and it's helped me to get sober. And I want to thank Billy for asking me to come out. I'm sure a lot of people say that. But thank you. I want to thank Luke putting my name on, giving Billy my name, and then Chris, my other friend who wasn't able to make it tonight, who I'm in here in his place for. So, but I am grateful to be here. I wouldn't have always said this, but I love Alcoholics Anonymous. I really do. Just being in this meeting tonight and just meeting people who are members of Alcoholics Anonymous who I don't know has always, and more so recently in the past couple years, has always really just given me a lot of joy. I truly today believe that I owe my life to Alcoholics Anonymous and the people in it and the higher power that I was introduced to and have found through these rooms and through the steps. So I'm very grateful to be here. And I loved what we read at the beginning as a good reminder for me about what I'm doing up here, what the whole point of this is. And if you're new, welcome. And if you don't relate to my story or the circumstances of my story, or even my description and my experience with alcoholism, I hope you come back and come to some other meetings and listen to other people's experience. So I am going to tell you what I was like, what happened, and what I'm like now. And I grew up in Montgomery County, Maryland. And parents got divorced when I was young. Father has a large family filled with alcoholics, mental issues. My mom had problems as well. So you could say I was sort of had a little bit of a handicap from the start, you know. And I remember watching my father drink. I remember being afraid to ride in the car with him. I remember calling the police on him, you know. And I remember being somebody who was always very competitive and wanted to be the best at everything I did, whether it was school when I was younger. I played a lot of sports, so I always wanted to be the best on my team. If I wasn't, I didn't want to be anywhere in the middle. I didn't want to do it, you know. And so I had a lot of pressure, and most of it was put on me by me, you know. And I would say when I got into middle school, there was sort of a switch in my head, and I don't know what it was, but I went from thinking that being good or cool was doing well in school to being good or cool was hanging out with the kids who weren't going to school. And so in somewhere around middle school, I switched the people I was hanging out with. And if you hang out with kids who aren't going to school, you're probably going to be introduced to alcohol, and maybe quicker than the kids who are going to school. And that was my experience. I was introduced to alcohol through the guys I started hanging out with, whether it was them or their older brothers, and we started doing stuff. And by the age of 16, I had dropped out of high school. and I remember the first time I got drunk, I was 16 years old. And I had done some other stuff before that, but I remember when I got drunk the first time, because I remember getting sick, and I hated getting sick. I remember throwing up and acting like a fool. I remember blacking out. I remember coming to and on the bathroom floor, and I remember saying actually the first of many prayers, those foxhole-type prayers that I would say throughout my drinking, whether it was after I got arrested or after I got in trouble of some sort, you know. And my prayer this time was a simple one, actually. They would become a lot more dire later on. But this prayer was, please, if you make this feeling go away, because I was laying on the bathroom floor, the room was spinning, and I was sick to my stomach, and I said, if you just make this feeling go away, God, I'll never drink again, you know. And I was lying already. I just started drinking. I was already making broken promises to God, you know, and because the feeling went away shortly after. I passed out. I came to the next day, you know, and the truth is I was unaware of it at the time, but I had discovered something that was going to change my life. It was going to alter the course of my life. It was going to alter the course of my thinking and was going to take me down a road that I was unaware of even existed. Like I said, I had some alcoholism in my family. It never even crossed my mind. My uncle was sober. He had had seizures at some of our holiday parties when he was trying to stop drinking. And I had seen this, but it never crossed my mind, you know. And so here I am, 16 years old. I drop out of high school, and I begin this path of just drinking. And when you're 16, and I did not look, I probably looked like I was like 13 when I was 16, you know. So I wasn't really, I was stealing liquor. I was stealing it from my parents. I was stealing it from friends. I was tapping people on their shoulders. I was getting fake IDs. And my drinking very quickly became a regular thing, an almost everyday thing at this point. I had no job. I stole from my family to do what I wanted to do. And I had the type of parents, and I know this isn't everybody's experience, and I had the type of parents who would, they didn't know what to do with me, you know, but they weren't the strict type who were going to lay down the law and say, if we catch you drinking again, you're out. And so I had free rein to kind of do what I wanted to do, you know, and so I was that guy who everybody wanted to come over to my house, like, let's go party at John's place, you know, they got loose, they're loose over there on the rules, you know, and so I would have people over to my house all the time, and we'd hang out and drink, and I started suffering some real consequences from my drinking around the age of 17, where I started getting arrested for committing crimes, burglaries, and a bunch of stuff, and I was under the influence, getting citations for drinking and at parties and stuff like that. You know, nothing major, but I started feeling some consequences, you know. And I was a blackout drinker, and I'm sure, I'm pretty sure everybody here knows, but if you don't know what a blackout is, it's when you're still awake, functioning, but you just don't remember what's happening, you know. And blackouts, when you're 16, can be cute, you know, like, oh, you know, you were funny last night. You know, do you remember what you said to so-and-so last night? And it would be like, no, I don't remember. And they would tell you, and it would be like, oh, that's so funny, you know, John. And then it started to get worse. You know, it started to be like, do you remember what you did to that person? Or do you remember hitting that guy in the face? Or do you remember saying this to that woman? You know, and it wasn't so funny anymore. You know, and it started to be where somebody would say, do you remember? And I'd say, stop. I actually don't want to know. You know, I got my arms, I got my legs, there's no blood on the front of the car, so we'll be all right. You know, and it got to the point where I was waking up in the morning literally in a terror, knowing I had drove somewhere far away and drove back home, looked out the window, the car was there, and I would have that sinking feeling like, I need to go check that bumper. Because last night I remember a lady yanking her dog out of the way of me coming around a turn, you know, and almost killing somebody. And that was an everyday occurrence for me. As a teenager, I was drinking and driving every day, you know. And what started to happen is if you drink and drive every day, and I know this isn't, again, everybody's experience, but I started racking up the DWIs. At 18, I got my first DWI. I don't know why. People talk about drinking and driving, and they would say, well, you know, I got my DWI. I was at the bar. And I had, you know, a number of drinks, and I drove home, and then I blew into the thing, and I was a point, you know, 1-1, or, you know, and I just missed it, you know. I was almost safe, you know. I almost didn't get it, and or 0.09, or whatever it is, you know. I was not that type of drinker. I was the type of drinker who would refuse. I would refuse to blow into the breathalyzer. My lawyer, after my incidents with the law, said, do not ever blow into that thing ever again, because they will find out that you are triple, quadruple the legal limit, you know, and that is not good evidence for court, you know. And so I was like, I would refuse. I'd be like, I'm not blowing into that thing, you know. But I was also the type of guy who would drink and drive. And by that I mean, like, case on the back seat, drinking and driving, you know, and which doesn't even make any sense, because I didn't even have anywhere to go. It wasn't like I was, like, going somewhere. I just would get in my car, pick somebody up maybe, and just drive around and drink. And it doesn't even, I don't know why I did that, you know, but if you do that enough in Montgomery County, you're going to get pulled over. You are going to get pulled over, you know. And so my first DWI, I run a stop sign, I pull into a 7-Eleven, and I get stopped in the 7-Eleven, you know. And the problem with me is that I'm also a Dr. Jekyll and Mr. Hyde, which it talks about in the literature. You know, I'm not somebody who gets drunk and is a quiet, happy guy who's just happy to see you, you know, and just hand me another beer. You know, I'm the type of guy who turns into somebody who the anger and everything I've been holding in starts to come out, and I'm angry. I'm angry, I'm belligerent, and I'm very verbal about how I'm feeling, and you become somebody who I want to take that out on, you know. And so here I am, I get arrested and I punch the officer in the face when they arrest me. So not only did I get a DWI, but I got an assault charge on a police officer. You know, and I end up getting 3 years backup time for this as my first charge as an adult. And so here I am, and one of the things I like to talk about with my alcoholism is, you know, when I got sober, I was 22 years old. So I got sober pretty young, you know, and I would have told you the first time I went to rehab at 17 that I was an alcoholic. I never wanted to say it, and I refused for a while to say it because I knew what that meant. That meant that I could never drink again, and that meant that I have a problem. So admitting that openly is not, again, not really a good thing to do if you plan on drinking, you know, and so... But internally, I would have told you I was an alcoholic, and the problem with that was I didn't know what an alcoholic was. I thought I knew what an alcoholic was. I thought it was somebody who got DWIs. I thought it was somebody who wet the bed. I thought it was somebody who blacked out. I thought it was somebody who was homeless. I thought it was somebody who, you name it, I thought that's what an alcoholic was. And what I came to find out through going to meetings of Alcoholics Anonymous and working the steps was you could do every one of those things and be an alcoholic, and you could do none of those things and be an alcoholic. And what I had to see was that my relationship with alcohol was different than a normal person. And what that came down to is when I drank, I had no control over how much I drank. And that experience comes out many times throughout my drinking. And the other part of that is when I stop drinking, I always start drinking again, regardless of how bad it was. And I say that because I had those 3 years hanging over my head. And the judge let me know very clearly, John, if you get arrested one more time, I'm going to give you all 3 of those years. You know, and that is, I am not somebody who wanted to go to jail. Jail did not seem like a fun vacation or trip to me. That seemed like this is not going to be fun. But here I was, 3 weeks after getting that arrest or after getting that sentence, I was drinking and driving again. I was drinking and driving again. You know, and I just was unable to remember, unwilling to change. And so at 19, I got my second DWI. And at 20, I got my third DWI. And through my family paying for lawyers and a bit of luck with some police officers getting shipped off to service in Afghanistan, I was able to not spend much time in jail for these DWIs. You know, and by the time I was 20 years old, I had 3 DWIs. I had pushed everybody out of my life. I went from being somebody who loved to hang out with a bunch of people and go to parties. I loved talking with women. I loved going out and doing stuff to somebody who preferred to drink alone. I like drinking by myself. And there was a number of reasons why I like drinking by myself. I was a fool when I drank. I would say, like I said, belligerent stuff. I was not a nice person. I became someone who wet the bed. I became someone who could scream at you or who could cry. I became someone who wanted to end his own life. And by the age of 20, I preferred to drink alone, and I preferred to drink cheap vodka or Mad Dog 2020 in my bedroom. And I worked. I had a job. It was a blue-collar job. I'd work Monday through Friday, sometimes Saturdays, and the second I got off work, I went straight to the beer store. I went home, I drank, and I passed out, and I did it all over again. And on the weekends, those were my times to shine, you know. And the reason I say that is because the weekends were the time where I knew I could get one on, and when I woke up, I was going to get it on again. You know, it wasn't like I had to get up and go to work. I knew Friday night when I started drinking that when I woke up, whether it was probably going to be at some point in the middle of the night, you know, maybe 3 or 4 in the morning, I was going to wake up and I was going to hammer down whatever was next to me because I could pass out again. You know, and I got into this cycle of drinking every day and on the weekends drinking all day. And I got very sick. I lost a lot of weight. I turned yellow. I had a number of stints in rehab centers and different inpatient treatments, whether it was court-related or whether it was just me wanting a break from the way I was living. And by the time I was 21 years old, I had nobody left. You know, I was living with my father. My father was, like I said, he had been a drinker for a long time, and by this point he had stopped drinking. When I was 16 years old, my father had open heart surgery and almost died, and he stopped drinking, you know, and didn't like drinking anymore. And I don't think he could really handle it with how sick he was, you know. So I'm living with my father. My brother lives with us too, and I'm stealing from my brother. I'm stealing from my father. I'm stealing right out of his wallet. At this point, my father's company has failed, and he doesn't have much money, and I'd take the last 20 right out of his wallet. You know, he was in a lot of pain. He had bad arthritis, and I would take the last pill that he had to help his pain go away, you know, and I would be sneaky about it, you know, and so here I am. I got no friends left. I'm drinking myself in and out of consciousness, and every Friday I'm getting paid, and I'm thinking, well, I could go down to the trains and gun store right here and pick up a gun and end it, or I could go get some more alcohol. And the problem was, is once I started drinking, I never had the guts to pull the trigger anymore, you know, so I would just drink and drink and drink. And I'd lost my license. I had three. When you get three DWIs, you're not going to drive for a while, just so you know. I didn't, at least. I lost my license. My license got revoked for 3 years, you know, and I had continued to drive. By this point, I was stealing my father's car, and I would end up in weird places with the car. I would end up, I'd end up getting a knock on my door in the morning. John, the car's in the middle of the lawn, the engine's running, and the door's open. You know, what did you do last night? You know, and I was a... you know, the type of guy who would pass out behind the wheel. I had several instances where I would be driving and I would come to and I had fallen asleep driving. And one time I remember coming to around that turn and a lady yanking her dog out of the street and diving out of the street as I almost killed her. And I remember coming to in front of the University of Maryland driving on the sidewalk where students would be walking, you know. And I remember coming to one night on Route 50, going to the beach because I was dating a girl who wanted me to go to the beach with her. And I told her I'm not going to the beach because I knew it was going to affect my drinking, you know. But then I got drunk and I was like, well, hey, what's she doing at the beach without me, you know. And so I decided I was going to drive to the beach. And on my way down there, there was a traffic jam and I had my vodka, you know. I was going to space it out across the trip so I could make it, but I got into this traffic jam, and so here I am pounding this fifth of vodka down. You know, the next thing you know, I black out. Next thing you know, I come to, and I'm in the Jersey wall going 60, 70 miles an hour, you know, and I regain control of the car, and I pull over, and I take a nap for an hour, you know, and you just brush it off, you know. And these were the types of things that happened to me. These were the types of things that I would tell myself, I can't do this anymore. You know, I'm done. I'm not going to do it anymore. But I didn't grasp what it meant to be an alcoholic. I didn't know that I had the inability to stop those things. I didn't know that on my own, no matter how much I wished it, no matter how well my intentions were, no matter how I was raised, the principles that I was raised upon, on my own, for some reason, whether it was a week later, a month later, I would always go back to drinking. You know, and the first part of the alcoholism that I wanted to talk about with the allergy is that, you know, I was also the type of guy who would get in trouble with people, whether it was family or girlfriends, and they would always say something like this: John, why don't you just drink like a normal person? We all had two drinks last night, you know. And so the story is I would end up out with a girlfriend at one of her friends' houses, and I would make a fool out of myself there, you know. And the story would go something like, John, you slapped this person in the face, and you went to the bathroom on this person's floor. You did whatever it was, and it happened a lot. I would, the next day, feel totally embarrassed. And my girlfriend would say something like, hey, they're having another party tonight, and I really want to go, but they said I can't bring you because of the way you behave. And I would be totally embarrassed because I cared what people thought about me. You know, I didn't want to be that guy. And so I would promise, I swear, I will not have more than one drink tonight. I'm just going to have one. You know, and I would go with all the intentions of having one drink, and I would have that one, and I couldn't stop. Once I have that one drink, something would switch, and I'd think, well, you know what? Two drinks never hurt. Three drinks never hurt. And the next thing you know, I'm getting kicked out of the party again, you know, and then I'm totally isolated, and I can't go out with her anymore, you know, and that became my life. You know, and at the age of 21, I was drinking, and like I said, I was drinking on that cycle of drinking every day, and then on the weekends drinking around the clock. And this particular day, I had a Friday and a Monday off work, so I had 4 days of just straight drinking around the clock. You know, and on the fourth day, I went into a 7-Eleven by my house that sold beer, and I went to re-up on my supply because I couldn't drive anymore. I was walking and hitchhiking at this point. And I picked up my beer and I brought it to the counter, and the person working at the 7-Eleven said no. And I don't know why they said no. I think I was probably pretty drunk at the time, but I think they had also seen me for years walking in and out of that store. And on this particular binge of 4 days, I was looking pretty rough. And the guy said, no, I'm not doing it. I'm not selling it to you. You know, and I proceeded to make a scene. It's about 1 p.m. People are getting their hot dogs and their, you know, Slurpees, and here I am. And what do you know? They call the police. And so I end up outside, no beer. And there's one thing I said I was never going to do, it was hit another police officer, you know, because you just realize if somebody walked up to me with a gun and, you know, held a gun, I was like, you better do this. I'd do it. You know, and here I am striking somebody who's armed, you know, and the police officer walks up to me, and the first time I always said it was because the cop grabbed me, man, and that's why I hit him. And this time the cop didn't even grab me, and I just swung and hit him, you know, and I ended up in jail that day. And the difference was I sat in jail for a month this time because nobody bailed me out. And it wasn't that it was a lot of money. It was $250 to bond me out of jail. And I sat in jail for 32 days on a $250 bond. And if anybody knows what that means, you know. And I tell that story because every day I sat in jail, I was convinced that I was done drinking. There was no way I was going to go back. There's no way after I realized that there wasn't a person left on this earth who wanted to help me, or so I thought, that I was ever going to drink again. You know, and I got out of jail after 32 days and I was drunk 7 days later. You know, and I remember it because I went to my probation officer and she said, I was already on probation, go figure, for something else. And she said, you violated your probation by going to jail again, and we're going to send you back to jail. And I remember leaving there, and I remember calling my mom, who lived in Florida, and I said, Mom, I'm sober 39 days. And she said, I'm so happy. I hope you can stay sober. And I got off the phone with her, and I looked over to the right, and there was a liquor store. And the thought crossed my mind, you know, I could just use one of those little miniatures. And I just need to round the edges, just sand it down a little bit. You know, I'm going back to jail. I'm sleeping on my grandfather's living room floor. I got no money, no job. I need something to round the edges. And there's that insanity. There's that insanity it talks about. You wonder what it talks about if you're new. And I was offended by you calling me insane, by the way. I was like, I'm not insane. Anybody who had seen my life up to this point, anybody who had seen the way I drank, could have said, if somebody said, what is the worst thing that guy could do right now? They would have said, drink. And I did it. I went to the liquor store and I bought that miniature, and I had that feeling, you know, that feeling like, this might not be a good idea, but I'll be all right, you know. Drank that miniature, and you know what happens if you're like me. There's another liquor store a little further up that street, and I got a fifth, you know, and then there's another liquor store further up, and I got a half, and I stayed in the woods that night, and I was off again. And my drinking continued like that off and on until May of 2005, and in 2005, my drinking wasn't even the worst that it had been. I was drinking probably once or twice a week when I could. I was still living with my grandfather. They let me back in after that last binge, and my grandfather was a big drinker. He was about 80 years old, and he liked to buy 6 half-gallons of, you know, like Aristocrat, the plastic halves, you know, for like $50. You get like buy five, get one free, you know. And, so he would go to Frederick, Maryland. He would drive like an hour to pick up these 6 halves, you know. And he wouldn't drink a lot. He didn't need a lot at that time, you know what I mean. He'd measure out a couple of shots, you know, and put them in some cheap orange diet soda, and that was his drink. You know, and so I'd wait till they went to sleep, and then the end of my drinking was that. I would wait till everybody in the house went to sleep. I was living on the floor, and I would go in the kitchen, I would pour myself cups of vodka, and I would drink them in the dark alone, because it was the only thing that gave me any relief. The only thing. And I didn't mention the fact that from the time I was 18 till I was 22, I had been in and out of Alcoholics Anonymous, because the first time I got arrested for my first DWI, I was sentenced to attend some meetings. So I always had AA in my mind. I'd gotten sponsors, but never worked the steps. I'd gone to meetings, but never really paid attention. I was focused on hanging out. You know, it was fun. It was different, you know. But the truth was, is I did not grasp recovery. I didn't understand, like I said, what it meant to be an alcoholic. And so by the age of 22, I hadn't been back to a meeting in years. My drinking was just too bad. And what ended up happening to me is I ran into a guy. And this might be somebody's experience here. I was a retread. My nickname in my home group up in Maryland is 24-hour John. And they've called me that since I was sober. They still call me that today. And that's because I picked up so many 24-hour chips. The chips that they still call me that. I mean, I have newcomers today who are like, "You're 24-hour John," you know, and it still bruises the ego a little bit. I'm like, "Yeah, that's me." But here I am, and I run into this guy who I had actually brought to an AA meeting. I was that guy who people would call me up and be like, I got my third DWI, or I got this, you know, and I'd be like, I know exactly where you should go, you know, Alcoholics Anonymous. I'll even take you. You know, I'd take him to the meeting, and I'd be like, this guy needs help. And then I would leave. And I would go drink myself in and out of consciousness, unwilling to change. So I run into this guy, and I had brought him to a meeting a couple years before, and he was still sober. He was sober, and I knew this guy. He was a drunk, you know, and he had a suit on. I'm going to go into some outside things here that I wanted when I was new that made sense to me. He had a suit on, he had a pretty girl on his arm, and he had a nice job. But that was as far as I got at that point, you know. And I said, "What's up?" And he said, "I'm sober. I've been sober two plus years. Life is good." And he was like, "How are you?" And I was like, "Well." And he's like, "You look like you're dying." And I thought that was a little inconsiderate and harsh. But you know what? He broke through enough. And he said, "Do you want to go to a meeting with me tonight?" You know. And like I said, I had no friends. I had nothing. I worked this job, and I worked to drink. And that was it. And I said yes. And I have been coming back here ever since. I got a sponsor. The first thing I did pretty much was to get a sponsor. At the time, I was working probably 50 to 60 hours a week doing blue-collar, you know, labor work. And I was attending meetings every day. You know, I wasn't married. I didn't have any kids. So I had a lot of time on my hands, you could say. You know, and I attended meetings every day. My sponsor and I immediately got into the book. And you know, we were talking about before the meeting. I was blessed with to be a part of a home group where the steps and the book Alcoholics Anonymous and service and unity, they were all very important. They were all stressed by the members of my group. And you know, one of the things I realized was I had been coming in and out of AA for years. And when I came back that last time, there was a group of people who were still there. There was a group of guys who were still setting up the chairs. They were still making the coffee. They were still talking to their sponsors. And they were still sober. And this epiphany came to me. I thought, well, maybe if I just follow those guys around and do what they're doing, I might be able to stay sober too. And that was something I had never thought of, you know. And so I got one of those guys to be my sponsor. And we started going through the steps, you know. And I was very, you know, like I said, I did not grasp what it meant to be an alcoholic. I didn't realize that just not drinking was enough for me to stay sober. And I say that because if you're new or you come to AA and you just come to some meetings, what it looks like here is some people, we've stopped drinking, we sit around, we drink some coffee, we talk to each other, we become friends, and then we're good. You know, and it's not like that. You know, and that's what I thought. I thought if I just could stop drinking, life would get better. You know, and what I was introduced to was a program, a different solution, and it was going to require me to take some actions. It was going to require me to have some faith in something bigger than me. And so my first step took time. It took time for me to really understand that I was powerless over alcohol. My life had become unmanageable. And I can tell you that all of the steps today in my life have continued to grow through my relationship with God. I've had a better understanding of every one of the steps, and they've all changed and evolved, and the words in this book have started to mean different things to me. Sentences in here, I mean, I was reading with a guy this week, and I was reading something, I was like, man, I never saw that like that before, you know. So it's amazing that this book, one book like this, can have so much meaning and so much depth over the years, and it can constantly be evolving. And so here I am, I'm sober. My first step is as good as it's going to get. My second step, you know, where I was not raised in any religion. I was not, didn't go to church. I didn't have that. So when you would talk to me about God, I didn't get it. You know, I wasn't really interested in that. I thought God was for people who were weak. I thought that I didn't need a God, you know. And my father and his large family of Catholics, you know, all had God their whole life. And my father said he didn't need it anymore, you know, and I listened to that. You know, so here I am in AA, and they're talking about God and coming to believe in this power. And I was like, nah, you know. But I'll tell you what I believed in. I believed in those guys. I believed in those guys who were still sober. I believed in the stories I heard from the podium. And my sponsor, being one of those guys, said, why don't you just get on your knees and start praying at night and praying in the morning? And I said, okay. You know, and so my first prayers in sobriety would go something like, I'm talking to the air right now, and this is really weird, but I'm going to do it anyway. You know, and I hope something's there, and please help me today, and thank you. And they would start out like that, and it evolved. You know, and I came to believe through going to meetings and through listening to other people that there was something bigger than me. And I will say that very quickly I made a decision. I made a decision I was going to give AA a shot. I was going to give it everything I had. I was going to be honest with a sponsor. I was going to go forward with the rest of the steps, something I had never done, by the way. In the years I had been going in and out of AA, I had never done a four-step, honestly. I was never willing to do that. There was no way that I was going to tell somebody else the stuff I had done. You know, I was, I had some stuff that I was really embarrassed about that had happened to me when I was drinking. I had some stuff that happened when I was younger that I was really embarrassed about that I was going to take to the grave. I had done some stuff to people, hurt people, that I was really ashamed of, and I was never going to tell anybody about. I had a bunch of petty resentments at people that I never wanted to admit to. I had some fears that were not the type of fears a man talks about with somebody else. I had treated women in ways that I didn't ever want to tell anybody mentally. Physically, I had been abusive to a girlfriend before. I didn't want to ever tell anybody that, you know. And these were all things that for years coming in and out of AA was just not on my list of things to do. But finally, I got to a place where I made this decision where I was going to give it a try. You know, and I believe that those first three steps for me happened very quickly to the best of my ability. And they've grown since. But that first meeting, those first couple meetings I went to, I was willing to, you know, I was willing to admit that I was an alcoholic. I believed that maybe AA could help me. And I made a decision that I was going to give it a shot. I started my four step and I did a fifth step when I had about a month sober. You know, and so here I am. I'm a month sober, working this same job, and my sponsor tells me to quit my job. He says, John, why don't you quit that job you're working? And the reason was is that I had been there for years, and the guy I worked with in the truck, I was a pool boy. I cleaned pools. And we would clean pools every day, but we would drink, you know. And so here I am, I'm newly sober, and we got a cooler in the truck, and we're drinking every day, you know. So here I am sober now, and this guy's like, hey, you want a beer? You know, and I'm like, no, no, every day, no, no, no. The problem is, eventually, for somebody like me, I was going to say yes, you know. I knew it. And so my sponsor said, why don't you get a different job, you know. So I go from working this job, and I'm at this point, I've been here a couple years. I'm making decent money, getting a lot of overtime. I start working at Starbucks, making coffee for people. You know, and I got to be there at 5 in the morning. My sponsor suggests I move out of my father's living room floor and move in with him, which was like, that's terrifying to move in with your sponsor. You know what I mean? I was like, I remember I was in my group, there's a lot of people and a lot of younger people and a lot of people live together. You know, you get these houses where you'll get four or five guys or girls and they'll all live together and we'll keep each other accountable and we'll, you know, do the deal, right? So here I am, and I remember going to this one guy, and I was like, hey, you know, I hear you got a room open in your house, and you think I can move in? And he looked at me, and remember, I'm 24-hour John, you know, guy who can't stay sober, guy who's probably not going to pay rent, you know? And he's like, well, you know, let me get back to you on that, you know? And he gets, and I don't even know if he ever got back to me. I probably had to track him down. And I was like, hey, you know, what are you guys thinking? He was like, I don't think we're going to be able to let you live with us, you know? And so this is the response I'm getting from all the people in the group, rightfully so. They do not have to move this guy into their house. So my sponsor, the last guy on the list apparently, was like, you can come and live with me, you know? And he was taking a leap of faith, you know? And he lets me move in with him and another guy who was a friend of mine at the time. And I was so blessed. It was just what I needed, you know? And for me, I got to spend more time with him. I got to see how he lived his life every day. I was 22 years old. I barely had ever held any jobs other than this pool job. And I didn't really do laundry. I didn't really pay bills. I didn't do any of that stuff. I was living very basic, you know. And so here I am, sober, you know, losing my mind, trying to change my life. I'm on probation. I might go back to jail, by the way. Again, I've got that violation hearing coming up. And I get to live with my sponsor, and he's showing me the way. He's showing me how to get up on time. He's showing me how to get to work, you know. And I remember he would drive me to work. I had to be at Starbucks at 5 in the morning, and this guy would say, "Wake me up, and I'll drive you," because I didn't have a license, you know. And I'll tell this story real quick. I remember one night I was thinking, you know, this sponsor, I don't know where he gets off telling me what to do, you know. I was like, this guy, man. And then I started thinking about it. I was like, I get it, man. This is like a power thing. This is a power trip, you know. And so I approached him about this in the kitchen one night. I said, hey, I said, you know, I just want to talk about something. I just feel like, you know, you're just sitting here telling me what to do, and I think you like it. You know, I think it's like, and he said something to me, and I'll never forget it, and I never once ever brought it up again. He said, John, you wake me up every morning at 4:30, and I drive you to work at Starbucks. And he just stood there and looked at me, and it clicked. And I said, I'm sorry. I'll never bring that up again. You know, and this guy genuinely wanted to help me. And the only thing blocking me was my ego. Every time, my ego. Here's a guy going way out of his way to help me, not only with taking me to work, taking his time to go through the steps, taking his time to share his experience with me, helping me out in any way that he can. And all I can come up with is, this guy's trying to tell me what to do. You know? Ego. That was my ego, you know? And so I do this fifth step, and I'm honest with this guy, and my life starts to change. I start getting service commitments at meetings. By this point, I had a commitment in my home group, and I had a couple other service commitments. And I want to talk about, you know, when I had about a year sober, my sponsor gave me a couple of suggestions. And I say this because I have a different sponsor today, and I've had him for a number of years. And I always think about this, is that when my sponsor gives me a suggestion, I don't know if that suggestion is going to be something that's going to change my life forever or if it's just going to be something small. I never know. And so it's hard for me to pick and choose what my sponsor suggests to me based on his experience. It's hard for me to say, well, that's not really a big deal, because I would have told you that these two suggestions he gave me when I had about a year sober would have been not a big deal, you know. And I can tell you that today I think about those two suggestions as some of the most important things that have ever happened in my life and have changed my life in a way that I could have never described before it happened, you know. And so here I am a year sober. I've done my fifth step. I would say, started to realize I had some character defects other than drinking. That's another thing, by the way. When I came into AA, I thought that drinking was such a large cloud over my life that I couldn't really comprehend the fact that I had other issues, that I was selfish and self-centered, as the book talks about, or that I had any of these other defects of character which are described in the literature. It talks about, you know, having defects of character, needing to turn those over to God. And so here I am, I'm sobering up, and I start to see that just not drinking again isn't going to be the solution. You know, I'm not, as people I hear them say in meetings, I'm not a nice guy who drank too much. You know, I got sober and John was still around. You know, the fearful John, the selfish John, the one who was just trying to look out for number one was still around. So I was causing harm in relationships. I was coming to my sponsor with problems, you know, like my employer asked me to go into the back today. They said they didn't want me up front with the customers, you know, and I'm like, I don't know why, haven't had a drink, you know, but I'm just bitter, you know, I'm angry, you know, and I don't like that guy at 5:30 in the morning asking me how my day's going, you know, how do you think it's going, I'm making minimum wage at Starbucks, making your drink, you know, and so here I am, I'm angry, you know, so I'm going through that, and I'm starting to see that maybe I've got some other stuff I need to work on, and maybe I need to start talking to my sponsor and people in the program about other stuff other than just my drinking. Maybe I don't need to be running all these other areas of my life like I thought I could, you know, because when I came into AA, I just turned over the drinking. I was like, okay, you can have the drinking, but I'm going to keep how I handle women, how I deal with money, what I do with my time, all that stuff, you know, but I won't drink, you know, and so I start getting in these jackpots in other areas. And I get to about a year sober, and I've gotten through, I've written an A step, I've started looking at making some amends with my family, I've started, I did not start paying back. I owed a lot of financial amends as well, and I was not paying those back right away. I don't know if anybody else has that experience, but I was like, what? Like, that? I'm barely getting by here, you know? I'm not paying money back. And so that was how it started for me. And at a year sober, my sponsor said, he said, John, you know, I take a meeting into this this inpatient facility once a week, and there's nobody, and my sponsor was Spanish, and so he would take the Spanish meeting, and he was like, there's no English-speaking AA meeting in this place on Wednesday nights. Why don't you start doing the meeting there? I had attended this rehab 3 times. However, I had a meeting I was already attending on Wednesday nights, and me and some other guys would get to the meeting early. We would make the coffee, and we'd play basketball outside of the church until everybody got there. And I really liked that meeting. It was probably one of the first places where I had started connecting with other guys in the program and felt like I was at home. So here I am with the decision my sponsor doesn't care about. I told him. I was like, well, you know, I got this other commitment. And he's like, and he does what the sponsor does, just like, it's up to you. You know, and I'm like, I know what that means, you know. And so I start taking this meeting into this treatment center, and I can tell you that when I had, you know, you had to have a year sober, and I had just gotten a year, and I, for every Wednesday for the past 10 years, have been taking a meeting into that treatment center, and I still take it today. And not only do I still take it there, but I still pick guys up from their aftercare houses. I still sponsor guys from there. And I have my life, if I could look at the trajectory of my life and the growth of friends and people who I care about, I have so many guys who I met in there who are sober today and who are on this path who I would call some of my closest friends. And I never would have met them if it wasn't for that treatment center. I never would have met them. Never. You know, and so it is a big part of my sobriety is trying to continue to carry that message to these people, and I'll talk about that more a little later. The other thing was, he said, you know, I want you to start having dinner with your father once a week. And I was like, you know, and you might think, well, you know, and I hear this a lot, and I'm gonna talk about my family for a while here, I always like to preface this by saying that not everybody has the same experience with their family. Not everybody gets a chance to have their family back. Not everybody's family reconnects. Not everybody will have relationships with a brother or father like I'm going to describe here. And that's okay. What I have found is that it's not just my family, meaning my father and my brother. I have relationships with people today, period. So whether you have that or will ever have that, relationships are the key. And I'm going to talk about a couple of them with my close family. And I didn't like being around my father. And the reason I didn't like being around my father was because he loved me. And it made me sick to my stomach because I hated myself. Anybody who ever complimented me, I couldn't take it. I don't know if you ever had somebody give you a compliment and you're just like, stop it. You know, I don't want to hear that. And that's how I was because I hated myself. I felt so bad about who I was and the way I lived. And my father just wanted to tell me he was proud of me. You know, and he wanted to talk about stuff, and he wanted to find out about my life. Because guess what? I didn't have one for years. He watched me drink myself to death almost. Literally watched me every day, cry myself to sleep, piss the bed, drink, and I wasn't living. You know, and now I'm sober, and my father wants to be around me. And so I said, all right. And so I start going over to my dad's house for dinner once a week. And it started out with me going over there. I wouldn't bring anything. I wouldn't help him cook. He would make dinner, I would eat, and I would take a nap on his couch, and I would leave, and I'd go to the meeting. And after a while, I remember having a thought. I went to my sponsor. I was like, hey, you know, sponsor, when I go over to my dad's house, I don't bring anything, and then I take a nap afterward. He was like, what? He's like, what do you mean take a nap? And I was like, well, I eat. You know, he makes food. I eat, and I go to sleep. And he was like, that's the only time you spend with your father all week, and you're taking a nap? And so I stopped taking naps, and we would eat, and we would conversate for the rest of the time, you know. And then I started thinking, and I said, hey, Dad, why don't I start bringing some stuff, and we can cook it together, you know. And he said, okay, yeah. And then I said, why don't I bring it, and you relax, and I'll cook it, you know. And what started happening is I started having dinner with my dad on Wednesdays, and I started calling him on Saturdays. And I don't even know why. I would just call him just to say, hey. You know, and then things started happening in my life, like good things. Like I would get a different job or like something great would happen and he'd be the first person I wanted to call. I'd call my dad up. I'd be like, hey, Dad, this happened. You know, and my father and I over time became closer and closer to where I was talking to my dad almost every day. And I looked forward to having dinner with him. And that was because of AA. And there came a day where I realized that I needed to pay him that money back. All the money I had stolen, the cars I'd wrecked, everything. And I sat down with my dad and I said, Dad, I want to pay you this money back. And for the first time since I got sober, he got upset and he said, don't ever bring that up. He said, I don't want that money. He said, do not ever bring that up to me ever again. And I remember leaving feeling a little confused, like what just happened here. My dad and I have gotten real close and he doesn't want this money, you know. And I remember I went back to my sponsor. My sponsor said, well, maybe you can try at another point, you know. And what I did was I started putting that money in a savings account without him knowing about it. I didn't even tell him, you know, because I had a thought maybe he might need it one day. He was kind of sick, you know. And about 6 years sober, I came back from a vacation with my friends, and I remember it was one of the greatest trips of my life. And I was at peace, and I came back to a text message that my father had had two massive strokes. And he was in the hospital, and I was coming back from New Jersey. And I said I was going to go see him in the morning after I got a little bit of sleep. And I got a call that morning that he had had another stroke and that he wasn't going to make it. And I remember going to the hospital that day and spending the day with my dad. And my family was there. My AA family was there. Friends came and showed up for me. And they were there all day. You know. And I remember being around midnight that night. And everybody left. My family said, John, why don't you go home and get some sleep, you know? And I called my sponsor and I said, this doesn't feel right. I'm not leaving. And he said, don't leave, you know? And I sat there with my dad that night and I made the decision to take him off the life support, you know? And he passed away that night and it was me and two members of my home group there with me, you know? And when my dad passed, there was nothing between us, you know? We were, he was at peace and we were at peace, you know? Shortly after I had tried to make that financial amends to him, I had something change inside of me, and I don't know what it was, but I knew that there was a difference in me in the relationship with my father, and it was nothing that I had ever been able to create. And I knew that there was a God in my life, and I can tell you that through the ninth step is where I found that true peace, and I found a higher power through working the steps. And 6 months after my dad died, my mom got diagnosed with brain cancer. So here I am. My mom's got stage 4 brain cancer, and I'm not trying to bring everybody down, but I want to get through this because it's so important to me, and it's literally a story about Alcoholics Anonymous, and it's a story about the life that I have today because of Alcoholics Anonymous, you know. And my mom got real sick, and she was paralyzed, and I was able to take off work and go live with her in Florida and help her out, and I was able to buy a house. And when I did buy that house, I moved my mom up with me, and she lived with me. In January of this year, she passed away at my house, you know, and I would not have been able to do any of that stuff. I would not have been able to show up, and I cannot tell you, when I said at the beginning of this talk that I love Alcoholics Anonymous, I couldn't even lie and say I didn't. It's messed up. I love Alcoholics Anonymous, and I love the relationships that I've got to get to experience with my father, my mother. My brother, I have one brother, you know, when I was drinking with at my father's house, he moved out of the house because he couldn't stand to watch me do what I was doing anymore. And today he lives with me, and we're best friends. We talk every day. And he looks up to me, and when I got to make amends to him, he said, John, he said, I look up to you more than anybody in this entire world. You know, and that was because of AA. You know. And so here I am, I've got these stories with my family. I've got stories with friends. I've got a life today. I can sleep at night. I'm taking my own inventory now. I'm finding a relationship with God through prayer and through meditation. And now what do? I got to give it back. I have to. You know, when Billy asked me to come down here, there's no way I was going to say no. I would go anywhere for AA. You know, I have been given a life that I never would have wanted. Like I said, when I saw that guy in the mall, he had a suit on, he had a girl on his arm, and he had a good job, and that's all I wanted. And I can tell you that today, suit or no suit, good job, no job, girl or no girl, that I am content with myself most of the time. And that's because of the process in this book. That's because of the steps. And that's because today I have some freedom from the bondage of self, which locked me up my entire life. which had me drink because it was the only way I found freedom. You know, and so finding out what an alcoholic was took me time. But what I found was that it wasn't the alcohol, it was me. I needed a solution, and I could not find it in just stopping drinking. It didn't exist. I had to find something bigger, and I found it in the steps. I found it in listening to a sponsor. I found it in helping another alcoholic. And so today I try to carry that message to others, and I try to practice these principles in all my affairs. And I'm not perfect at it. I'm going to tell you right now, I make a lot of mistakes. I am still selfish. I still sometimes try to look out for myself. But I've got relationships with men in this program. I've got my sponsor, and I can be honest with them about this stuff. And I can look at myself today. I can look at myself and grow through my experience. And I am forever indebted to AA. You know, there have been times, and I'll be honest, over the past 3 or 4 years where I felt like, I don't know if I have time to do this stuff. I've had those thoughts, you know. And the truth is that I am forever indebted to Alcoholics Anonymous for the rest of my life. And if I stop doing this stuff, I will go back to that same self-centered, fear-driven person. And I'd be lucky if I got back to AA. I'd be lucky, you know. So I am very grateful to be here. Billy, I appreciate you asking me. I appreciate you all listening, and thank you.